There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dave Kidd of The Sun and Seb Stafford-Bloor of Football 365. Sorry about this, but it has to be done. VAR is football's three-letter, four-letter word. It's dominating debate, it's dividing fans and friends. It's dramatic, but destructive. Don't get me started on the new handball rule. It's a mess. What should we do about it, Dave?
Oh, scrap it. Maybe just have goal line technology. I'm an anti-VAR fundamentalist. I was before. Everything that's happened so far has proved me correct as far as I'm concerned. My main problem is a gut feeling, which is that I believe this issue separates people. Those who believe football is fundamentally entertainment for our enjoyment, what the working man did to go with his father and his son, or daughter and mother, to go and watch their football club and enjoy it on a Saturday afternoon, and when our team scores, to hug each other and celebrate, rather than wait for a guy in a truck near Heathrow to decide whether or not someone's big toe was offside. It's a very fundamental thing with me. After that, which I can't personally get over, I just do not want VAR. I believe it's a sport to enjoy. I don't believe it's a science. I don't believe it's a business. I don't believe that because there's big money in the game, we therefore have to have this ultimate justice, which is unattainable anyway. But further on from that, in terms of the actual technicalities of where we are at the moment, it seems to me, and I've heard this said, and I don't know the exact yes or no of this, it seems to me that the handball law has been altered to suit VAR and to make it more black and white so that VAR works better, which is the tail wagging the dog. That is something that may be smoothed over, I think. It's my assumption that VAR is not going to go away, but I don't actually believe this thing we keep hearing that you can't put the genie back in the bottle, that once you have VAR, you can't step back from it. I don't believe it's an inexorable tide. I believe that if enough managers, players, administrators, fans dislike it, and we're seeing more and more people coming to that point of view, then it can be reversed. We can step back. Mm. We can just go with line calls. I don't think many people are opposed to goal line technology. And that's where I am on the debate. I'm probably still in a minority, but I think I'm in an increasingly large minority of people who would just rather bin the whole thing.
Yeah, that one's seconded for me. But you were at City on Saturday evening, Seb. You know, we talk about, well, slide rule, efficiency, it kills spontaneity, but also we're talking about the handball rule there. To be honest, we can read the laws, but do you actually understand what's going on? Because it's so inconsistent.
Not really, Mike. I mean, this is a point Pep Guardiola made after the game. He was talking about his issue really wasn't with the goal that was ruled out in stoppage time. It was with a failure to award a penalty against Eric Lamella in the first half. But he did talk about sort of three very prominent handball incidents in the last 6 months. So obviously the one which occurred on Saturday night. The block on Sadio Mane's shot in the Super Cup, which wasn't given as a penalty. And then the Llorente, inverted commas, handball at the Etihad in the Champions League quarterfinal last season. It's a strange thing because I've been watching the game for over 30 years and I feel that now I don't really understand the handball laws anymore. And I think Dave covered it. It's being constructed now in a way which makes it black and white for the purpose of VAR's interventions. And I think whilst anybody who watches the replays of that goal back now would say, yes, that's clearly been influenced by handball. Sort of the received wisdom which has been built up over the last 100 years really is that that is not really within the spirit of an infringement within the box. That is not a player punching the ball into the net. That is not a player trying to influence the pattern of the play by using his hand. It's baffling. It's baffling. Take all the tribalism out of it. And no, I didn't hate seeing that goal being disallowed, but I feel like what we're watching isn't really football. It's kind of physics and math sometimes, which I think is, especially for the people in the ground. I think I've been at 3 games so far this season, and I must have seen probably about 7 or 8 VAR checks. The majority of those have not been intrusive. They've not affected the spectacle. But when it does, it's very strange. It's a very strange
thing. I'm going to picture then of that goal, in inverted commas, in the 93rd minute or whatever it was on Saturday. What was the move? You know, your instinct is right, goal.
Yep.
Or rewrite. And then it takes too long to actually come to a conclusion, doesn't it? So what's the mood in the stadium like?
Okay, well, so initially delirium because City have won the game. Now the kind of the new instinct is to watch the referee, to watch what he's doing with his hand in his ear, and you know, especially because of what happened last season. So all eyes on Michael Oliver. Nobody in real time really spotted an infringement. There was no question of offside. So it was sort of...
You thought to look, did you, when you were in...
Absolutely. Because of what happened last season.
Yeah, and I was there last season when it happened.
Exactly.
It was absolutely. You know, I just... No one saw that one coming. I didn't see that one coming.
No. I mean, I was at Stockley Park before the season began. Yeah. And I'm aware of the speed at which these checks take place and what the intention is. And sort of Oliver started to kind of walk back towards the halfway line. There was no indication that he was really being advised that there was something within the passage of play which needed to be looked at. And so you thought, goal. So I was on with my, and so it seemed aspect of my match report. And then he walked back to the 18-yard box and disallowed the goal. And then on the screen, the no-goal decision came up. And it was bizarre because it was sort of, obviously, different parts of the stadium recognised that at different points. Mm. So you had this sort of shattered response to it, which was very strange. It's going to take some getting used to because it's against everything that I've got used to inside of football.
No Spurs players were...
Well, look at Hugo Lloris's reaction when he's told by the referee he starts laughing.
Yeah.
Which is very, very instructive about... I mean, I...
Players know, you know,
yes,
well, any
exactly.
of us, top-level players who play the game all their lives, they know the spirit of the game. They know when something is amiss and when it isn't. And if there'd been any chance, I mean, footballers are cheats. All footballers are cheats. They will any 50-50 throw on that they know is actually going the other way, they will appeal for it.
There was not
they will
a single appeal
for anything. And no Spurs player.
Not a single one.
Yeah. I don't think any West Ham player appealed for the Brighton goal that was disallowed for offside in the first half on Saturday either. I mean, I don't think there was any appeal then for offside. That's the level of vernickety kind of, you know, the way it's being looked at now, forensically. That's the sort of level we're at, where nobody who's actually on the field playing the game or in the stadium seemingly has any idea there's been an infringement. And I was there for the Sterling goal in the quarterfinal last year. I remember Lingard's goal, which would have won England the semi-final against Holland in the Nations League. It was another one where in the stadium no one had a clue. Just a great delirious celebrations, and again a minute and a half later it seems all cut dead.
Yeah, because football in essence, Seb, is a game of human error. It's defined by human error in many ways. So we're moving away from that. His human error, you know, I'm looking at City's performance against Spurs.
Yeah.
There wasn't an awful lot of human error in that performance. Okay, they dropped their first point since January, but that was another indication of how good these guys are.
They were fantastic. I mean, they were... I couldn't... Even now, 2 days later, I still can't believe that Spurs didn't lose that game because they got battered. They didn't play very well. They really did get away with one. But I thought so many aspects of City's performance were brilliant. I mean, Guardiola afterwards spent more of his time talking about what pleased him about their performance than he did about VAR. Mm. He was very enthused about Kevin De Bruyne's return to fitness, which is actually the kind of the hidden subtext of last season. Mm. You know, Liverpool were almost perfect, missed out by a point, but you could probably describe City as being underpowered for most of the season because he wasn't really a factor.
Played 11 games in the league.
Absolutely.
He's their best player. He's still comfortably their best player.
And he was magnificent. When he's playing well, when his vision and his range of passing and his execution on the field, all of the other parts around him make so much more sense. And Spurs, time and again, it looked like they were making obvious errors. So there was always space in both of their channels. City were able to move the ball upfield as if they were, you know, shadow playing in training. It was that easy. And that's really a mark of how accomplished City are, because Spurs are, I'd say, the third best side in the country, beaten European Cup finalists. You know, this is not a game against a no-hoper side. That is just a measure of the gulf that exists between the very top of the league, and which is City, and everyone else, with the exception of Liverpool.
Mm. I'm a bit concerned about City's defending. Yeah. I still think, despite everything and the way they absolutely dominated a very good team, and 30-3, I think it was.
Yep.
That Tottenham's first goal was just to move straight down the middle. The goalkeeper should have saved it. The defender should have dealt with it. Then there's just a corner that isn't, you know, Moore is allowed to win a header, goes 5-8, wins a header from a corner, and that costs you the game. And that is, you know, Guardiola himself says, that's the great thing about football, is that you can have all these percentages in your favour. You can have 80% possession, you can have 30-3, and you can still end up not winning the game, and because of basic defensive errors. And my concern is that City, I mean, obviously Kompany was the age he was at, but he still, I thought, shored them up massively in that run in last year. Stone seems to be gone at all levels. Otamendi, I don't think he's absolutely top.
Why is it with Stones?
I'm really surprised they didn't bring in a centre-half.
Why is it with Stones, do you think? Is that a confidence issue, or has he just been found out?
It seems like more of a mental issue, yeah. It does seem as though, you know, it's been talk of personal issues and things like that. I just don't think he's the player he was a year or two ago. It seems to be quite long-lasting, and I think I'm really surprised City didn't address the issue in the summer. I still think that could end up costing them a title.
Mm. I wonder how easy it is to be a defender at Manchester City. I mean, it's kind of, it's the modern equivalent of being Manchester United's goalkeeper after Peter Schmeichel. Like, it's almost an attribute of its own to be able to play in a system which is exposed to danger so rarely for a side that almost always dominates possession. It's kind of the demand is almost for a different sort of defender. It's kind of the issue which, amongst a few others, which costs Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League every single year, is that they individually, they have competent defenders on the pitch, but as a system, it's not exposed to enough of a threat on a regular basis to really harden those defensive attributes. It's a theory. It might be very tenuous, but it's just, you look at that City defence, maybe with the exception of Zinchenko, who I don't really think is a fullback, and he's a nice footballer, but he's not a defender for me. And you think, for someone like John Stones, would being more regularly involved, being more tested on a week-to-week basis, would that be to his benefit over the long term? I don't know. Maybe.
You know, we know from circumstance how much of a perfectionist Pep Guardiola is. Let's look at the flip side of that, Dave, if we could. That spat with Aguero, was that ominous?
No, I don't think so. I think we love it, and I love it, and my newspaper loves it when there's a big profile fallout like that, and we love watching it. It's, you know, it's like we rubberneck at car crashes, don't we? And we like to watch, you know, a top manager, you know, having it out with its leading player. It's got a compelling quality to it. But I think they're both excellent professionals. They've worked together so far for 3 years fairly harmoniously. I think Guardiola, you know, in the early days, brought a lot extra out of Aguero, who, you know, who's become a far more rounded footballer under him. And I think it was just two guys who wanted to win a match and having different opinions on how City best did that. It was funny, obviously, another thing with the VAR decision we overturned is they were almost making up, weren't they, about it, weren't they?
Kissing his neck.
During celebrations. Yeah. If actually, I told you so, Jesus has scored. Hey, there you go. And then, actually, no, he hasn't. So, therefore, was Aguero right then, maybe?
Is Sterling more of a pet project? Because here's someone who came in. Guardiola talks about his capacity to learn from mistakes. Mm-hmm. He's developing his role within the team, you know, 7 in 4 games. He could be their main goal scorer this season, couldn't he?
Absolutely. He actually reminds me a lot of Pedro at Barcelona under Guardiola, in the sense that sort of a lot of his virtues within that side are tied to his movement and his ability to be a kind of, and this is meant in a flattering way, a system player. So he's an extension of everything that City do well, in the sense that he is the player that best exploits their movement and the kind of displacement that causes in a defence. I mean, I think Raheem Sterling's success actually speaks quite highly of Raheem Sterling the person, because he's had to suffer a lot of criticism. I mean, it seemed as if for about a year we talked about nothing else other than his, you know, inability to finish chances properly. Mm. And that's really improved. And also, there are the darker issues that he's been exposed to, which he's done tremendously well to cope with, and he's just a great success story. But yeah, he looks like he's entered the season red hot.
Mm. Let's look at Tottenham and the sense, Dave, almost that Mauricio Pochettino's, there's a bit of frustration still bubbling under the surface. He's talked about the vulnerability that they're under now in, before the window closes in Europe. Has he been sort of outlevied here?
Yeah, possibly. I think he's. I'm not entirely convinced. Everyone says that Spurs have had a great transfer window. I think one of the great strengths of Tottenham under Pochettino has been the fullbacks. When Walker and Rose were particularly flying a couple of years ago, obviously Walker's long gone. Trippier was very good, had a poor season last year where he had one or two issues, but I still think, quality player.
See the ball he put in
Atletico last night. Yeah. Atletico Madrid don't tend to buy and start with Muppets, do they? Trippier's still a very good footballer. Trippier's gone, hasn't been replaced. Rose could well go before the end. Rose, I think, was back very close to his very best last season, the end of last season. Quality player. And if Rose goes, which is quite possible, I would argue they haven't replaced him because Sessegnon, having watched a lot of Sessegnon, is, for me, a forward player. Yeah. He may get away as a wing-back, but I think I'd always want... I mean, I've spoken to Alexander Mitrovic, who's told me he'll end up being a great number nine finisher. You know, that's what he thinks. He thinks he's that good a penalty box predator. That's someone who knows what he's talking about. So I don't think Sessegnon is a replacement for Rose. A lot of people seem to be saying that. I'm not convinced Pochettino thinks that. I think he thinks he's a very good player, but I don't think he thinks he's a left back in a flat back four, certainly. So therefore, I don't understand why Spurs have gone and weakened themselves significantly, potentially, if Rose goes, and they're willing to let him go, in those two fullback areas. And I think that's going to really cost Tottenham over the course of the season.
It's going to be a nervy few weeks, isn't it? A couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I agree completely with what Dave says. I mean, Sessegnon can play fullback. I don't think that makes him a fullback. That's just a kind of testament to the breadth of his ability. The worry for me, I mean, the long-term worry on the left side is obvious. At the moment, the right is probably worse because the long-term plan is to play Juan Foyt there. But that's a kind of theory at the moment. I know he plays there for Argentina, but at club level, he's not proven there. Serge Aurier can't tackle, which is...
Well, he wants out anyway, doesn't he?
He wants out. He may well go back to Paris Saint-Germain, apparently. As I understand it, the decision to sell Kieran Trippier was not a football issue. So it's a strange one. I think Spurs have done some very good things over the transfer window. But had we been having this conversation 6 months ago, I'd say that the priority had to be those fullback areas because Tottenham have never been a better side to watch than they were when Walker and Rose are on either side because that's where the power and the width comes from. That's where the gear changes in their sort of temperament came from and it's never been replicated. They finished last season very well. They got the Champions League final. I'd say they were not actually that great last year, especially on the Premier League.
Didn't they?
Exactly. 13 matches, but they end of the season when they were just dead on their feet. They had no width. Yeah, they became very, very predictable and fullbacks were a must and that hasn't been done.
How do you see Eriksen playing out?
I think he'll go. I think he should go. I think one of the great disappointments from Saturday, you know, among a few, was his performance because this is a player that Barlakans wants to play for a club of Real Madrid size. And you think in that context, you are playing in a headlining game against a very, very strong opponent. That is your chance to not necessarily have your very, very best game, but look as if you want to take command of that game. And I compare his performance with someone like Eric Lamela. Lamela is a flawed player, I accept that. But if you look at his determination to be involved again and again and again and compare it with sort of the passive nature or passive tone of Eriksen's performance, I don't think that's a very flattering comparison. I don't think that speaks to someone that could cope with existing in the kind of rare era that the Real Madrid play in. Certainly not.
He's one level down, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's not. He's a very good footballer. He's just not an outstanding one. And I think his best bet would actually be to sign a new contract. I don't think he'll do that. But if he's not going to sign a contract now, he's got to go.
There was like a player's head's gone, yeah, doesn't want to be
absolutely
there anymore. He's been there a good... How long has he been there? 5 years?
He's been there 2013, I think.
Well, he was one of the Gareth Bale...
He came in with the Bale
market trolley dash, wasn't he? that did work.
He's been excellent for Tottenham.
He's had a
very, very good Tottenham career. But if he's not going to sign a new contract, he's got to go. And if he's not... If his head is not in Tottenham season, he's definitely got to go. And if you take a little bit of loss on that, so be it.
Pochettino will want that, won't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. You were both at Chelsea yesterday. Mm. Dave, is there a bit of a pattern already emerging there where Chelsea have an absolutely stellar 15 minutes? They fly out of the blocks and then, you know, they're hanging on for dear life before the end. Is that the state of play there?
Yeah, he sort of said, you know, afterwards in the press conference, so that's that, you know, that first 10, 15, 20 minutes maybe, he said, that's how we want to play. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, we'd all like to play 100 miles an hour and you know, and create chances every minute of every game.
Because it could have been three or four.
But it doesn't work out like that. You know, A, there's the fact that you're going to get knackered, and B, there's the other lot. So, you know, it's not really a plan to say, right, we're just going to go for it and try and score as many goals as possible. That's not a plan, I'm sure. I'm not suggesting Lampard's, you know, not an intelligent football man, he is. But I think there's so many flaws in that Chelsea squad. It's the thinnest Chelsea squad for 20 years. And obviously that's because of the transfer ban. But they've lost an awful lot of star quality there. They've obviously lost one of the best players in the world in Hazard, more than anything. They've lost in Luiz. They've got they've lost a flawed player, but certainly the defender with the most character. He's gone, not being replaced. They lost Fabregas last season. I know he was coming towards the end, but he hasn't really been replaced. They had a couple of centre forwards who have been in or around world class in Morata and Higuain, who didn't do it for Chelsea, but they haven't been replaced. It looked like a League Cup team. And that's what they've got now. They've got a couple more kids who are good players, Hudson-Odoi, Loftus-Cheek, and then they've got Rudiger. And after that's the best they got yesterday. Yeah. It's not like they've got loads of players out. Mm. It's certainly not the League Cup team, but it looks like a Chelsea League Cup team of previous years. There's so many holes. We knew a lot of this anyway. Lampard knew a lot of this when he came in, and Lampard probably wouldn't have got that job if it hadn't been for the transfer ban. He was there to try and, you know, lift the spirits in reduced circumstances. And there was a real carnival atmosphere around Stamford Bridge before kickoff and for the first 7 or 8 minutes of that game when they were playing, you know, came at Leicester like a train. But it's not sustainable playing like that. And it's not sustainable trying to finish in the top four with that squad.
Mm. Mason Mount, you know, if you're talking about a feel-good factor in that, he embodies it, doesn't he? And young player of great technical quality. And, OK, there's improvement in him, but you can see that he's worth the act of faith.
Terrific player. Yeah, I mean, he's going to... important thing for him at the moment is that people have patience with his peaks and troughs, because that's part of a young player's development cycle. He's going to have bad games, but the positives he brings, it's very rare that you see a player like that make a Premier League debut at home, or even last week at Old Trafford, because he was very good for at least a half there. He's got everything you need to play as a kind of a modern number 10. I mean, he's an active part of Chelsea's press, where his goal came from. He makes excellent runs into the penalty box. He probably could have had two or three yesterday by half time. I think you know, Lampard obviously has a lot of faith in him. He's got an existing relationship with him. And that patronage is very important for a young player. If you compare it to the Callum Hudson-Odoi situation last season, when it became almost sort of Hudson-Odoi versus his manager at certain points, certainly around winter time, when a player feels that he's not, you know, one bad pass away from the bench or from being dropped, you know, you see a sort of a bolder product as a result. And he's very exciting. If he's not in the England squad, I'll be very, very surprised. He's terrific.
Yeah, but is that a warning inherent in that last sentence? In other words, don't rush him.
Yeah, sure. I think that actually, despite what I said, you know, and I do think Chelsea are going to struggle to finish top six even this season, there is that understanding, I think, from the club hierarchy, certainly from supporters, that this is a different season. This is and they've really wanted to see young talent flourish. They obviously, as Seb said, last season it was all about Hudson-Odoi playing. Obviously, unfortunately, it's a badly timed injury, because he surely would be starting, given this new ethos on youth that they've almost had to go with. So I just think that that there will be a lot more patience with Mount and with other young players there than there would have been in previous seasons at Chelsea. But the problem is that trying to blood four or five young players at once is very difficult. Trying to blood one or two is great. Four or five, there's not the right balance about the squad, that when things are going right, they do need the senior pros to learn from, to you know, take their lead from.
But does that patience exist with Frank Lampard, in terms of, you know, what football's like? Conventional wisdom, you know, soon becomes, you know, irredeemable truth. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, Lampard's great, but he doesn't know how to do a substitution. You know, he waits too long.
Yeah.
That's already being said, which is unfair in itself.
Yeah.
But
Chelsea are struggling after a couple of months and they're in the bottom half of the table, say, then there is going to be a lot, an awful lot. And then we're going to have to see whether this is a new Chelsea or not, aren't we? You know, whether Abramovich has in any way, and Marina and the people there have in any way changed and are able to do what they've said. I'm sure they said they were going to be patient with Villas-Boas when he arrived. I'm sure I heard that at the time. And due to Lampard and one or two others in the dressing room, it didn't happen.
Yeah. What about Leicester? I've got the hots on, right? I think they could even get into the fourth if the season goes perfectly for them. They should have won that game, shouldn't they?
Definitely. They had the chances to. I mean, the shame of it was, Mike, is they started so badly. They started, I mean, I remember writing, remember doing my intro before the game had begun and saying that, you know, in previous seasons, this is kind of a day out for Leicester, the Championship, you know, season accepted, of course. And this is in this context, this is a chance to knock over a fragile big side. And they started terribly passively. Yes, Chelsea played extremely well for 20 minutes and at an intensity that, you know, very few sides are able to match. But as if they were content not to compete in the middle of the pitch, they were defensively very, very suspect. I think Leicester are probably a year away from being in the top six conversation, depending on what, you know, how they invest. Because whilst they're very pretty, very effective with the ball and going forward, I've got a few issues with the way they look at the back. I don't think it's kind of... I think they've got to... you know, the displacement caused by Harry Maguire sells a bit of a problem. The Turkish defender, whose name I can't pronounce, is not quite as mobile. He's not quite as attuned to the pace of the game. He's a very good no-nonsense defender, but I'm not sure he has the kind of the breadth of abilities that Maguire does. So I still see it as a little bit of a top-heavy team. Jamie Vardy's getting a little bit older. I don't see a proper deputy for him at the moment. I'm not sure Iheanacho is going to pan out the way he was supposed to. So there are a few holes and it's quite a thin squad. I think a lot of the football at the moment is going through James Maddison, Tielemans. They're very dependent on Ndidi to kind of lock up the midfield at the base. So yeah, there's depth problems, there's consistency issues. One of the problems they retain from the Claude Puel era, mini era, I guess, is this weird capacity to look like three or four different sides within the space of 90 minutes. Like you can watch them in for a half and think, no chance, this is a mid-table side, all kinds of flaws. And then they come out off the break and they look brilliant. They played Chelsea off the pitch in the second half and they're a little bit more efficiency in front of the goal. They could have won 2 or 3-1, possibly.
What about Brendan Rodgers? You're remaking acquaintances with him again, Dave. He seems to be the perfect coach for that type of young and evolving team.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he got a lot of flack when he left Celtic, when he did, you know, when they were, you know, close to the end of their season. Go for that domestic treble as they always seem to achieve, and he did that because he genuinely felt Leicester was the right project for him, and it does seem like that. I think I agree with Seb. I was slightly disappointed with how little business they did in the summer. I know that Tielemans was there on loan, and they've had to spend money to bring him in and pray they brought in, and they didn't replace Maguire the way it went down to the wire, and they didn't. They obviously were looking for replacements and being quoted stupid money, and probably to their credit didn't go and spend the vast majority of it on a Dunk or an Ake or someone like that. But they haven't replaced Maguire, and that's going to leave a gap. And I agree. I don't think the squad is really strong enough to go top four or probably even top six. But they are an exciting side to watch. In that second half, they were excellent. You just feel it was sort of significant, the Maddison miss in particular. Yep. They had two or three very good chances to win it at 1-1, and I think they may end up regretting that. It would have been a real statement win. I agree with what Seb said, that, you know, to go to Chelsea, obviously they were vulnerable. They showed that second half and they didn't win it. And the fact that you go to Chelsea and you're very genuinely disappointed not to win suggests you're a good side, obviously, you know, but they should have won it. And I don't really know if... I like Rodgers. I like listening to him. I'm not entirely sure he is quite as good a manager as he thinks he is.
Okay, well, that's me told anyway. You're saying that you're at Tottenham on Sunday.
Yes.
And Newcastle visit. You know, you spoke about car crashes earlier on. What about this one? Newcastle, what are they doing?
Exactly what they always do. Shop downwards, replace one of the best defensive organisers in Europe with all due respect, a Championship standard manager. I mean, no offence to Steve Bruce, but, you know, that's not an appointment that was based on any kind of meritocracy. They look terrible without the ball. I don't want to take anything away from Norwich over the weekend because good performance, lovely hat-trick, but the regression is quite startling because, I mean, Newcastle had limitations under Benitez. I mean, that's fairly obvious. But what they always were, generally, particularly away from home, was very difficult to break down. And they really just kicked a couple into their own net on Saturday. I think about 3 weeks ago, I was doing a prediction feature and I had them to finish 20th, and nothing I've seen suggests that I'm going to be wrong yet. It's really disappointing because this situation has been going on for a really, really long time. And the Newcastle fans that sort of that complain about it are always sort of tarnished with but this is your entitlement. This is you thinking that you still belong in the top four. And it's not that at all. It's a fan base who have been subjected to illogical decisions for over a decade and a half. And they're never given an explanation for it. They are fed red herrings about phantom takeovers and illusory, you know, new dawns. And it happens again and again and again. And everything that people predicted about what Steve Bruce's Newcastle side at the moment is absolutely on the money, and that's got to be very, very dispiriting.
Mm. Because on, you know, to follow that theme, Dave, the recruitment process seems to mirror that, where it's almost like, let's just throw a few fish at the seals.
They haven't been spending money. The one big difference this year, the last two windows compared to the rest of Ashley's reign, is they have started throwing money. They're just doing completely the wrong players. I mean, Almiron looks a decent player, but they're broke.
He was completely anonymous.
But I think he's a reasonable player. But Joe Linton, looking at the record, you know, £40 million for a guy who's scoring. Well, he scored one goal every four games, I think, in Austria for a couple of seasons, on loan to Rapid Vienna and Hoffenheim. His record was fairly average. To suddenly go from not spending any money at all, and Michael Owen having still been there, you know, as famous as always said, Michael Owen was still their record transfer fee, like 12, 13 years on, 15 years on maybe, to suddenly throw £40 million a bloke, and he missed a glaring header, didn't he?
Yeah, he's got to score.
Then gets himself injured.
And that didn't look like a classic Newcastle number nine, did it, with that header at Carrow Road. It's a mess. I think they still have good enough players there to stay up, because there are a lot of poor sides in that division. By the skin of their teeth, I think they may stay up. I'm slightly less negative about Steve Bruce. I understand, but he's not Rafa Benitez, and I think when you've got a limited squad, you want ideally someone with the defensive nous of Rafa Benitez to make you hard to beat. I don't think Bruce organises defences anywhere near as well as Benitez does. I don't think he's clueless. I think he's a guy who's got a decent track record. I think his best days are probably past him though, and it's one of these strangely emotional appointments that have suddenly become de rigueur in Premier League football, which never used to happen. Solskjaer, Lampard, Bruce, you know, people going back to their roots and it all being very lovey-dovey. I don't think it seems to be working at any of those clubs. Mm. We'll see tonight with United. I don't personally think that one's built to last either. So, in Newcastle, it's a mess. It's a slightly different sort of mess than what it's been for the previous 12 or 13 years, but still a mess.
Yeah. You talk about managers making an impact. Jurgen Klopp, by consent, has done absolutely brilliantly at Liverpool. I thought that win at Southampton was quite emblematic of the team. You know, not a great... It was an ugly win in many ways. But coming after the Super Cup and the attendant travel problems and fatigue, that struck me as a really mature performance.
Well, compare it to Chelsea's. I mean, you know, I know Liverpool had a little bit of a wobble towards the end, and actually Adrian made an excellent save in the first half, which kept it level. But in terms of sort of a professional, composed, get the business done kind of performance, it was a measure of what that side has become and how reliable it is. And sort of, I suppose if you look at kind of the performance of Sadio Mane and Roberto Firmino, I thought Mane was excellent. And you look at how long they played for in Istanbul and how hot it was out there. It's a great credit to Jurgen Klopp's management that he's able to kind of to back up that performance. And also, not a Sunday afternoon performance, Saturday, 3 o'clock, which is especially difficult. Chelsea had an extra day's rest and they still managed probably about 30 minutes at full intensity. So, absolutely. Mm,
front three, all firing. And also, you know, what struck me about Klopp also was that he made light of that mistake by Adrian, didn't he? Which is, again, he knows he needs him for a few weeks.
Yep.
Just lighten up.
Yeah, I suppose when you've won, that's maybe easier to do. But yeah, yeah, I agree.
He's had some practice as well with that situation.
Yeah, so. Goalkeeping errors have been it's certainly been plenty of those. Mane's has just become a world-class player over the last 12 months, hasn't he? He's really gone up that level. He's been outstanding. And to have one in your front three is that good. Now they've got two. And Firmino's not far behind in his own way. Again, in terms of, looking back at the transfer window, I thought City would do one or two more than they did. And I still thought Liverpool would do something. Central midfield, number 10, something a little bit more genuine creativity. I read a piece by Ian Ladyman today saying that they should have signed Coutinho on loan, and I agree with that. I think that's maybe just the one thing they were lacking at times. It's difficult to say they were lacking anything when they won their last 12 or 13 games of the season and were champions of Europe, but there is still something that could be added to that squad, which bringing back Coutinho. In terms of his technical attributes, whether his head would have been in it or not, I don't know, given what's happened to him in Barcelona. But I think a Coutinho or a Coutinho-type player would add so much more to Liverpool. I know they felt a need to balance the books a little, but I thought just one more could have made a big difference to them.
Talk about balancing the books. Arsenal, who are at Anfield next weekend, they did well in that sort of transfer tap dance, didn't they, really? Got players in. Danny Ceballos, made a fantastic impression. I look at him and I think, there's a player who will be excellent September, maybe October, but you might find out a little bit more about him in November and December. Is that fair?
Couldn't agree more, because I think it's very, very difficult for a player to transition from not just Spanish football to English football, but a Spanish midfield to an English midfield. In August, at home, a little bit easier.
He was great, by the way.
He had a fantastic game. But I think also one of the problems for me, Mike, is that when there's no permanent clause in a loan deal, and when his future is, in his mind, presumably, the Real Madrid first team, what happens when he hits a dip? What is his mental approach to that? Is he someone that will say, right, well, no, I want a place in this team? Or does he think, right, well, the Real Madrid's perspective of this, are there caveats about how a player is going to perform in England, and is that going to affect my Real Madrid future? So what happens when that dip inevitably arrives? Because it will, and that's only natural. That's not a criticism of him. That's just the nature of football, especially for new signings with fatigue and those kind of issues. So let's hold on to the anointing oil with him for a few months, I think. Yeah.
What's your take on Emery? He talked about maybe not having as good a team this year as he had last year, which struck me as a bit strange. But
I thought they've had a good window, actually.
Yeah.
I like what they've done, given they haven't spent a huge amount. Pepe has spent a lot of money on. Ceballos looks like a really good player. You have to see with any player coming into the Premier League how they deal with that December, January period with no winter break. Well, there is going to be a one-week winter break, isn't there? But with the intensity of the way the fixtures come thick and fast during the winter months, yeah, and that's going to be a question mark against anyone. I like Tierney. I like Luis for them. I think they need a bit more character in the central defence. I know he's got an error in him, but I like that signing. I think they've done well. They'll certainly miss Ramsey. I thought he was outstanding. But I quite like what Arsenal have done. I quite like the cut of Emery's jib. I think it's very difficult to come in and replace Wenger, given the way the culture had been allowed to go under Wenger, the way it become pretty much a holiday camp, and try and just change the entire culture of the club. I think he showed signs of doing that last season. It finished disappointingly, but I think they've got a genuine chance of finishing top four. I think I would back them to finish top four at this stage.
Mm. Sean Dyche probably won the press conference on Saturday. What do you make of his diving comments?
It's difficult, because if you watch the game back, he has a little bit of a point. There are a few sort of not very flattering moments for Arsenal players in that. The problem with it is that he makes this point so often off the games, and it's kind of his default position to losing is to kind of to have this sort of broad, despondent, where is the game going routine. Mm. And I think deep down most of us kind of agree, but it's the boy who cried wolf. So yeah, maybe he should take a break from that for 6 months and talk about a few different things, and then it's hard because I like Sean Dyche. Mm. He's one of the few really honest managers in the league. And if you sit in a press conference with him, you get honest answers, and you can. He's very. He's very easy to talk to, and he's very forthright, and he speaks a lot of sense. But I just think that this kind of comment is always going to be picked up, and it's always going to be front and centre of any Burnley performance which is unsuccessful. And so it becomes an almost dead issue over time.
Pick your battles, don't you, as well? I didn't see it was particularly glaring in the afternoon.
I think you have to. If the game had been decided by something fair enough. But it was these were sort of... There were little incidents which you see in every game you watch at any level in any country, and it's kind of you know, this is not a challenge unique to Burnley, so is this really Sean Dyche's problem to attack, if that makes any sense? I'm a little bored of hearing it.
Okay. Well, I certainly think that Burnley are going to be nowhere near a relegation battle this season. So obviously the focus on that is on the teams coming up. Let's look at Aston Villa. They're learning the hard way that your mistakes get punished. They played 7 of their 12 new signings at the weekend. As a veteran of Fulham's attempt to throw stuff at the wall last year, what do you make of it?
There's a lot of comparisons with that. It's the obvious comparison to me. I think it's slightly unfair. I think, to be fair, going back to Fulham, I mean, it was two very poor, costly midfielders. Apart from that, we didn't spend vast amount, actually. They got it horribly wrong with Seri and Anguissa. But with Villa, it seems a bit more rounded to me. There was less panic buying right on deadline, I think I'm right in saying. It's always going to take an awful lot, you know, of gelling when you bring that many players in. But I don't think Villa were particularly good last season. I don't think there were enough. I think it's very easy to say, oh, you stick with the players that got you there. I think Norwich and Sheffield United were both much better teams. I think they did a great job under Dean Smith of coming late and then winning the playoffs. But I think they needed to do a lot of surgery. I think, excuse me, my ignorance, the player who scored the goal on Saturday,
Douglas Luiz,
looks a real player. That was a terrific strike. He looks a good player. Heaton's a good goalkeeper. There are players there that are known.
Tyrone Mings
is a really good defender. Yeah. There are a lot of known quantities that we know will do a good job in the Premier League there, and I think enough to probably keep Villa's heads above the bottom three. Mm.
What about Norwich, Seb? You know, you look at Norwich and you've got Timo Pukki scoring a hat-trick. Mm. Now, after that, it was interesting. The consensus among the recruitment community was that, had a heck of a season last season. He was a disaster area at Celtic. And probably his chance conversion rate won't be that brilliant in the Premier League. We scored 42 games.
And one really well taken goal at Anfield as well. That was the sort of, that really impressed me too. I mean, obviously, let's wait, because given what we've said about Newcastle and the issues they're experiencing, maybe that's not quite the right context in which to judge him. But I mean, his finishing doesn't look too much wrong with it at the moment, does it?
They've been good goals, haven't they? All four of them. Yeah.
But also, I think the virtue of Norwich is he suits the way they're trying to play. I think Norwich are one of the most, the times that I saw them last season, they're very entertaining to watch. They're very, very well coached. They actually remind me a little bit of Fulham when they were in the Championship, you know, in terms of how everything seems to be logical and how the players fit their different slots and how they combine. I've got a few questions over Norwich's defence. So let's see how many chances Pukki actually gets at the other end of the pitch, because that's the great problem, is not necessarily newly promoted sides carrying forwards who can't convert chances, but newly promoted sides creating chances for those players to convert. So another month on that one, I'd say. Let's see where he is in October, November.
Okay. What about Sheffield United, Dave? You know, first fully British or Irish team since April 2012. Wilder has probably made out a career out of being underestimated. Is he about to do it again?
Yeah, it's a club that's got a right fit, got a real sense of identity about it, and it just feels right. And I got a feeling they may well stay up as well. I love Bramall Lane. It's old school. The way that Wilder's built that team of British and Irish players, I think will limit his own chances of moving onwards to a bigger club. I think bigger clubs will look at Wilder, despite his amazing track record. And if he does keep Sheffield United up, and he's made a good start at it, 4 points from 2 games, you know, he should be someone destined for bigger things. I think it holds him back if he doesn't look to a broader, you know, range of players. But he's got that identity. There's a lot to be said for it if you are, without being in any way xenophobic, there's a lot to be said for having at least a very large core of British players if you're in a team that are going to be fighting relegation. That is going to be your priority. There is a lot to be said for those old school attributes of spirit and buckling down under pressure during matches, buckling down under pressure during a season when you've had a bad run, and being able to turn things around in the dressing room. Sheffield United have got a lot of that. They've also got some decent quality as well. Yeah. I just got that gut feeling that you know, having failed to stay out once or twice under Warnock, I think that Wilder will actually pull it off.
I'll tell you what, Mark, I saw them at Bournemouth on the opening day and they were terrific. They're a really, really good football side. They're not going to thunder into teams. They're not another Cardiff. They will outplay a lot of teams, especially at home this season. And that, I mean, especially Norwood in their midfield, Lundstrom as well, Fleck, that's a really good unit. And they will just be, Dave mentioned it earlier, there are quite a few poor sides in the division this year. I think they'll be too good for a few of them. I don't think they're necessarily playing for 17th. I think they'll probably be a sort of 14th, 15th place side by the end of the season.
Norwood has been promoted 3 years in a row.
Never given a chance.
Which
I find really strange. He looks a terrific player.
He's a really good footballer. He really is.
His delivery from open play and set pieces is brilliant. I can't believe someone hasn't given an opportunity, because he hasn't been costly, hasn't been an expensive player, but he looks great.
You mentioned John Lundstrom there. Scorer on Saturday, played in all four divisions, which I suppose brings us round to a final question about the power of the pyramid. You know, we're in a week where a Football League club of 134 years standing, Bury, could be out of business, out of the Football League by Friday. Mm. How scary is that?
It is very scary. I mean, this is Bury, a great historic club. The Shakers of Gig Lane are a famous team for anyone, you know, growing up watching English football. They're the team who, until last May, held the record outright for the biggest ever win in an FA Cup final, 6-0, which City equaled only this May. It's a great football club. Terrific place. I always remember watching them playing against Fulham in the third division in an era of hairy backsided centre halves, and they were always one of the teams who came down and played a bit of football, and I always had a soft spot for Bury. And we do rightly value the pyramid system. The one thing that is definitely unique about English football is the depth of support for local clubs down, you know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, going down to Conference North, where you're quite frequently getting four-figure crowds and 5,000 crowds. That is a great strength of the English game. That is a genuine thing to be proud of. But we haven't got the leadership in the Football League which recognises the role of supporters, which recognises the historic value of these clubs, and which is willing to actually legislate for proper ownership to act against rogue owners. And time after time, rogue owners are allowed to buy clubs. We've seen it at Coventry and Charlton, Portsmouth before that, Blackpool, various other clubs in recent years. The Football League doesn't get a grip on it. It's just a private members club which doesn't actually clamp down and realise the value of its own member clubs and their supporters. And that's the tragedy.
You agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, something that Dave said really struck me, though. It's like, the Football League's responsibility, among other things, is to protect the game from the kind of people that are trying to infiltrate it now. Now, the idea that there are charlatans and Walter Mitties trying to enter the game and use it for their own means is not new. It's been happening for decades. And so the idea that Bury's ownership situation is allowed to exist without the proper proof of funds, it's an extraordinary thing to me. I know the damage is being done by the individual. I understand that.
He would argue that he's got all the evidence available, but he's just not given it to the Football League.
It's kind of, I don't understand that then. I mean, it's just a kind of, that's a contradiction in terms, really, isn't it? It's a sort of, if no good ownership situation really begins with any scenario in which an individual is unable to prove their worth. So the Football League needs to be stricter on who it allows into the game. And the Football League are not alone in that challenge, because that's a question for UEFA, that's a question for the Premier League, that's a question for leagues all over the world. But this is not a unique situation even now. If we were talking off air about the problems at Bolton as well, and it's not an identical situation, but it's got some very familiar themes within it.
Mm. Well, football is awash with money, but you can't buy what clubs like Bury represent. They matter, and they must be protected. Thanks for joining us here
on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.